This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guests are Pascaline LePeltier and Alice Firing, collaborator and author of the new book, The Dirty Guide to Wine, Following Flavors from the Ground Up. We'll talk to Pascaline and Alice about what else? Dirt, and why it's so important. We'll taste a perfect summer muscadet for our weekly wine sip, and Pascaline snuck in a few bottles, which is nice. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Pascaline LePeltier is a master sommelier. She is the beverage director and partner at Rouge Tomat in New York City. If you look up Chenin Blanc in any dictionary, you'll see a picture of Pascaline. Alice Firing is a James Beard and Louis Roeder award-winning journalist, blogger, consultant, and author of, and I have to warn you, Alice is an expert at long-titled books, author of The Battle for Wine and Love, or How I Saved the World from Parkerization, Naked Wine, Letting Grapes Do What Most Comes Naturally, and For the Love of Wine, My Journey Through the World's Most Ancient Wine Culture. Alice also publishes the Firing Line newsletter, focusing solely on natural, organic, and biodynamic wines from the ground up. Pascaline and Alice's new book is The Dirty Guide to Wine, Following Flavors from the Ground Up. Welcome back to the show, Pascaline, and Alice, welcome to the Grape
Nation.
Thank
you. Thanks.
It's great to have you guys here. Alice, Pascaline has been on the show before, and she's told us a little about her background and all that. What I want you to do is to give our listeners a little background on your journey in life and wine that got you to this point, which right now is the dirty guide to wine. So just give us a little background and context.
All right. So I had a different career. I was a dance therapist, and I did that for 10 years.
Makes sense.
And I went back to... Yeah, it makes sense, right? But I went back to... an earlier desire to write. And so I moved back to New York City. I said, hello, New York City.
Where
I'm a writer.
Where did you move from to?
I was in Boston for my master's and then to practice.
Okay.
And trying to figure out how to get back home. And I finally did it and really gambled away my life to be a writer. And I didn't want to be a writer who was a waiter or had another job or a temp. And so I thought, I have a great idea. I'm going to do freelance writing, even though everybody told me it was the stupidest idea in the world, but I did it anyway because I was hard-headed. And one of the things that I knew something about was wine. So I started writing about wine, food, and design, and I was just like any other schlep wine writer going
on. So you can't start from there and move forward.
What happened
got
about
you
that?
Interested in wine, or, you know, what was the moment you shifted to wine?
Well, I had an Yeah, I started out in Lancers and Matus like a lot of people in my generation.
Fancy stuff.
Yeah, or even before that, I was drinking Manischewitz and Carmel Extra Sweet, even before that. And by the time I got into college, I started doing some more explorations. I got to Boston, and I had a roommate who was a wine collector, and I do something crazy called Morris dancing, and a fellow Morris dancer had a wine collection. And so my apartment became the nexus for twice-a-week wine tastings.
Wow.
And I never wanted to learn about wine, but after 2 years of trying to get to the bottles that I liked best before anybody else did, so I had more for myself, I realized I knew something.
Do you remember the type of stuff you were tasting? Was it... It was a step up from the Matus and Lancers.
Oh, no, it was good stuff. I mean, we were exploring...
California, France. I mean, what were you...
We were mostly focused on some of the new stuff that was coming out of California. It was the late 70s, early 80s.
Interesting Northern, time for wine.
Northern Piedmont, Burgundy, Barolo, Pied de Beaujolais, the Loire.
Right.
We were doing classics. At that point, you could still get some old-fashioned Riojas because it was just what everybody made. Right. Everything was old-fashioned.
Right.
So I had a pretty good 10-year training of just tasting without having any idea that I was going to do anything about it.
So you come to New York.
So I come to New York, and I'm writing, and I have no desire to be a wine writer. I never wanted to be a wine writer. And then I was offered to do a book, the Food and Wine Magazine, Food and Wine Magazine Wine Guide in 2001. And that's when I realized that my favorite wines were disappearing. And I really thought that the world was in danger of losing the great treasures. And none of my colleagues would do anything about it. I went into a little bit of, actually a lot. I went into overdrive, started spending a lot of time in vineyards, spending a lot of time talking to winemakers, starting to travel a lot, and realizing the problem was just more than the egregious new oak. And it was all this wine manipulation as well as abysmal farming. And
so you're alluding to a style. Mm-hmm. You could, I guess, pick out like a Napa, where it was an oaky, big, unctuous fruit bomb, and everything was made that way.
Right, and it was an international scourge.
Right, and Bordeaux's were like that.
Exactly.
They were scoring for Parker.
Exactly.
Right. So that turned you off.
Yeah, and so I wrote my first book because that was when I became a wine writer.
Right.
That is when I really said, okay, this is what I've got to talk about.
Right, and you took a little crap for that book, right?
I still take crap for that
book.
You
still take, okay. All right, so you go on to write a couple more books.
Right.
Before you get to The Dirty Guide to Wine.
Okay, so Naked Wine I wrote because natural wine started to become a thing, and I realized that...
Tell me when to you, because I've been covering natural wine the duration of, you know, my whole show. Mm-hmm. Very important, popular issue, subject. When, to you, in your mind, did the natural wine thing sort of hit you or you took notice?
Well, it hit me in 2000.
Okay, so it's 17 years already.
But I had to put things in perspective. When I wrote that first book, even though I clearly was talking about natural wine, I'd never use the word natural wine.
Right.
Even though my last chapter was all about Renaissance and Loire and what was happening there with all of the, what we view them as natural winemakers. But the term was not
used. Pascaline just woke up. You said Loire.
It was the alarm rang.
Right.
So it really only started being, in France it would be like, you know, Bar Vin Naturel, so the natural wine bars, but it really wasn't used much in the United States. And it was just wine. It was just wine that we were drinking.
Right.
And so it really started becoming a threatening term around 2009, 2010.
We'll talk about that a little later, but I wanted to get a context. So you're saying 2000 and then 9, 10.
Right.
We'll catch up to that because I want to get into the book before that.
So I wrote that natural wine book a lot of people were going to be knocking off natural wine. A lot of people were going to be marketing themselves in natural, and a lot of people were going to fake it. And so I wanted to make sure there was something out there that gave the history, where it came from, that this overnight sensation actually took 40 years.
And at that point, there was really nothing around?
There was nothing. Well, there was not true.
Nothing major or...
No.
That's why you broached the subject.
Right.
So that comes out. So you are one of the early voices for natural wine and continue to be one. Let's get to the third book.
For the love of wine, we can shorten the titles to the first one. Leave the subtitle on. Just leave the parkerization one and forget about the rest. All all comes from the editorial board. So that was about my love affair with Georgia and Georgian wines. And the natural wines of Georgia.
The country of Georgia. Which has an ancient history to wine, how they make it in amphoras and the style and all of that,
absolutely.
Right? So you... Brief description on overview of...
Well, 8,000 unbroken years of winemaking heritage deserves its own book in the English language, I think. So, and now it's also in French. But so that was really it. And it was covering what I view as the pioneers of this new venture, this post-Soviet Georgia wine culture.
During the Soviet takeover, were they making wine or they were suppressed?
They were only allowed to make wine professionally in the wine factories, in the state-sanctioned wine factories. But everybody in the country made wine for themselves.
Right.
And there are people who ended up in... Actually, in my newsletter in the next issue, I'm going to be talking about some guy who ended up in the clink for being busted for selling his own wine during the 80s.
But that all opened up now. I mean,
now it's fine.
It's
yeah.
a much
it's,
better
It's flourishing.
Market. So you mentioned the firing line. You wrote the three books, the book we're going to talk about, your fourth, but you launched the Firing Line newsletter when, in the early 2000s?
No, right before Hurricane Sandy. So that's 2013?
That's when it started, I thought, before.
No.
So it's about 4 years
old. It's going, it's Hurricane Sandy anniversary, it'll
wow,
be 4 years
that's
old.
That's memorable. What was the inspiration for that? I mean, at some point you sat down and said, you know what, I really need to get this on paper, organize it, and get in front of people.
Well, I've been blogging since 2004, but in 2013 I took it to a subscription only.
That's my misunderstanding. 2004, you've been blogging.
Yes.
About natural wines?
And about wine, it was my
wine,
diary.
Everything. And then... In 13.
It was, I think it started because people really want wine recommendations for me, and it's probably my least favorite thing, so I thought I'd make it a job.
Okay. Why is it your least favorite thing? People always say to me, Sam, give me a good restaurant, and I get stuck. And then I'll walk away, and nine will come into my head.
You know, I don't mind recommending, but there's a certain tedious work of getting everything down, and it's a form and a format of the way to write it, and
right.
to get, and it's just, it's not what I really want to spend my time writing. I want to spin a narrative. So that is very much work for me. And so I turned it into a little natural wine newsletter.
Okay. All right, so... That gets us current because you wrote Naked Wine around 2016, and it's 17 and...
Naked Wine 2011,
For the Love of Wine
2016, and now
Thank you.
2017.
Right, 2017.
Another book. Yeah, right.
Right, and we'll talk about the firing line later, too.
Okay.
All right, so Pascaline and Alice, let's talk about the book. One of the ways I want to frame this is I read the book. I loved it. It helped me with my wine knowledge, and I think it'll do that for anyone, whatever your level of interest in wine is. There's so much information in the book. I mean, it's really chock full of information. So I think it'll be impossible for us to cover it all here. So let's try to cover the most useful and important aspects of the book. You know, help me with that. But whatever we have to do. So my first question is, obviously, how did the idea of the book come about?
Well, the idea of the book came about because I was asked to write a beginner's wine guide.
Okay.
And I know it may not seem really obvious to make this a beginner wine guide, but I really started thinking about how we have started learning about grape first, and you do a grape exploration, and it seems to me all backwards and wrong, especially in an age and a time when wine grapes have become style more than an expression of the place. And so that was my initial idea, to bring it back to actually one book that I wish existed, and I wish I didn't have to write it, which was a book that is broken down into subsoil. And
right. Which we'll talk about the specifics and all of that.
But also to bring it back to, you know, yes, milk comes from the udder of a cow, right. And right. And grapes do come from the hand of man is sticking them into the earth, and what earth that is.
Right. People have, when you read the book, you'll have an idea of what kind of earth there is. When are we talking about? I mean, when did all this discussion of writing the book, are we talking a couple of years ago?
We're talking a couple of years ago. Okay. I probably signed the contract 2 years ago.
Okay. And when did Pascaline become involved and you guys started working together?
Oh, Pascaline was written, well, probably by the time that I started writing the proposal. Pascaline, do you want to? Hi,
yeah.
Pascaline.
I'm not sleeping.
Come on. No. Of course not.
I think it's yeah, like we had a couple of conversations. Like we have been Alice and I knowing each other for 10 years, and
so the relationship way pre-exists.
Absolutely.
The idea of the book and the writing of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think maybe not formulated, but the way we have been testing together definitely led us to really think about the wine world a lot, about the
similar sensibilities.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so the dialogue and the idea of, you know, putting together a region because of their bedrocks and the way we're filling the wine came through a lot of tasting we are doing together. So I think the thing happened when Alice was really wondering about, okay, I don't want to write that beginner wine book, but if I have to, this is probably the angle that I would like to take. And we are talking all the time together, so I remember you sharing in, like, with me and talking about that when this in Alsace.
And you were at my kitchen table, and you said, I want to do this with you.
Talk to me about logistics then. Obviously, you had to do a decent amount of travel, I mean, to really witness whether it's volcanic or sedimentary. So you guys embarked in a decent amount of travel?
In a perfect world, that would have happened, but we really drew on... We travel a lot, and we've gone to a lot of places, and there was some travel
past
that did
experiences.
Happen. Right, and okay. There were some new things that we logged up in that time, like Mount Etna, you know, going to Sicily and other places like that.
Right.
But because we didn't have the amount of time that we wanted, we just had to.
Right. So you pulled from your past experiences.
And made a few future ones. Yeah.
Right. And... Were you tasting a ton of wines?
Well, Pascaline's always tasting a ton of wines.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're tasting a lot of wine. We also, like, the thing with that book is, in fact, where the deadline was quite short. We were lucky to be able also to go to massive big tasting where we could meet a lot of winemakers. And let's say in the book, we are talking about some people we may have not visited after the contract was signed.
Right.
We visited them before, and we were very lucky because we had, I would say, quite great relationship with a lot of these winemakers. So definitely they were a massive help, and we could ask all the questions we wanted. So
right.
So that was also a big help for certain regions that we already visited, and we wanted to have more details on, let's say, Alsace or others. We knew who to talk to, and they knew that they could be very, very transparent and very detailed, and definitely gave us a lot.
I remember emailing you, telling you I was coming to the restaurant on a Sunday night, and it wasn't that long ago. I mean, it was like the beginning of this year, and it's like, I got to stay home and finish this book. I'm like, what? You're not done with it yet? I mean, so it went. Sounds like it went down to the wire, but...
Well, it was a kind of thing. It's like, Pascaline, you've got to, like, you know, double-check all this stuff. And she's like, I can't for another week. I said, it's due Tuesday, babe.
Yeah, right. And Tuesday's around the corner. All right, so let's get specifically into some important parts of the book. I'll set it up. The book, The Dirty Guide to Wine, organizes wine not by the grape or region, but by soil type. That's, you know, a big theme of the book. So let's start. I need you guys to help define for me and the listeners, what is soil and why is it so important to wine? And I think this is where everything breaks down into categories and regions and all of that. This is where there's a lot of knowledge. So what is soil and why is it important to wine?
Well, soil would be decomposed rock.
Okay. Is it the same everywhere?
No.
Okay. Are there...
It comes from different sources. The original material comes from different places, whether it's volcanic or from the seabed.
Right.
Or whether it changes over time.
So if you look at a vineyard, there's layers, right? There's the topsoil, which is usually the dirt. Mm-hmm. Does it go to a second and a third layer?
I'm shaking my head, yes.
What are they?
Yeah, I think everything, like as Alice said, everything depends, and we can break it down quite easily on topsoil and subsoil. So there is one of the things that was a common mistake that we also had to correct. And
which was what?
Like everybody call like talk soil. About soil when they talk about, in fact, bedrock. You know, when you go to a winery and they say, you know, my soil is limestone. In fact, the bedrock may be limestone, but the soil...
Limestone is a bedrock.
It's a bedrock.
Which is, in your guy's description, a type of soil or part of the soil.
Well, there was a disclaimer in the book that said, usually in the book, when we're talking about soil, we're talking about either subsoil or bedrock. And it basically is the shorthand that the rest of the world uses, but... You need to remember that it is the shorthand. So we,
right?
We had the whole in the introduction of the book. You have that, and yes. You have that topsoil when you have what is really what you're talking about is like centimeters that are a mix of organic matter and
then you said
and
a mineral subsoil.
Absolutely,
below that.
Yeah. So you have that mix on the top that can differ wherever you are in the world. If it's weathered, if it's not weathered, and sometimes somewhere, some places, you are in direct contact with that bedrock.
Right.
It's very rare because most of the places on Earth have been, you know, weathered and have been also worked by humans. So you have a lot of that topsoil that's everywhere. So when people are talking about limestone, granite, basalt, and all that kind of thing, they are mentioning what is under, below that topsoil. That can be
which really
couple of centimeters.
Identifies the area. Mm-hmm. So you break it down into three types. The bedrocks, I guess, fair to say. And Pascaline, they are igneous,
absolutely, yeah.
Which is
basically
volcanic.
Volcanic is one of them.
What are the other two?
So it's basically the two main sides. When you think about this type of soil, the best way to think about it is like is the earth is what's coming from the magma, and then there is two ways: either they explode or they stay under the crust of the earth.
Right.
So the explosion is what people refer with volcanic soil.
Right. You know, it's kind of funny, but you're bringing up something. Writing this book, learned so much because when I always used to think of granitic soils as volcanic because it all comes from, you know, the lava, right?
That's
but
what
no,
I thought.
But not geologically. So it's whether, you know, it is trapped under the earth and it's under pressure, and that is what happens with granite, or whether the magma flows and then hardens, then decomposes, and that would be basalt. So,
are basalt and granite under the category of igneous?
Yes.
Volcanic?
Yes.
Okay.
So just on that note, and I think it's quite important for us to mention, the book per se is not a geology book.
No, I think that's important.
And that is
that's why I said when you talk about it, it can go that way, and I don't want anyone to think.
It's not. We don't pretend to be geologists. We don't pretend to be scientists. We don't pretend to say that we are going to tell you technically what we are going to talk about. We are just using this perspective and this angle to kind of break down the world of wine and to draw new perspective. So it's not like you are going to learn exactly what is a mineral compound of basalt and all the physic characteristic of basalt, so on and so on. It's not technical like that. Mm-hmm. What we're going to put together in the main region of the world where you can find this soil type, and we are going to suggest that if you taste them side by side or if you enjoy them together, there may be something that's going to link them. So we are not going to describe the relationship between pH and soil and pH of wine. We are not going to get into that because first is absolutely not our specialty. We are not scientists on that side.
Right.
I'm a sommelier and Alice is a wine writer, but we are going to say, you know what, when we taste this wine together, our experience and our tastings led us to think that, you know what, there is maybe something to think about between Etna and Teide and Tenerife, and what about tasting them together?
So the question I had was, can you really taste the dirt? And the answer is yes.
Well, actually, you really can taste the dirt, and all you've got to do is see what happens when somebody goes from conventional farming over to organic or biodynamic farming and see the change. So talking about that kind of dirt, yes, you can taste
right.
that. And a lot of, so there are a lot of changes in farming, so on the topsoil, and
it's more lively. We'll talk about natural and organic wine, which also leads to the type of farming. But just to finish, and I don't want to stay nerdy, there's the volcanic rock, there's the sedimentary rock, which is sort of a slurry dust, and then there's a metamorphic rock, which are spread out through different wine regions in the world. Metamorphic quickly is what?
Metamorphic just means that there is a transformation, metamorphic, that the change of the structure that is linked to pressure and heat, to make it simple. So a soil that was something, let's say mud or clay, can have been transformed through pressure and temperature, usually because there is eruption or there is, you know, mountain formation of things like that, and that changed to something else. And in the case of, let's say, the mud or the clay, may became shale, which is one phase. It is just compressed, and then if it's also metamorphism, become slate or schist. So all these soil type are can come from either igneous origin or sedimentary origin, and they are going to get transformed.
Right. There are some areas in the world where the type of rock is sort of indigenous to that area, right? Like, is there an igneous sedimentary or more metamorphic area only?
It's very hard to get 100% of one soil type.
Okay.
But we know Burgundy is classic. You know, it's limestone,
right.
So of different variations.
Right.
So that is, you know, the classic.
Right. So in a sense, yes.
Yeah.
But,
Mount Etna, there, basalt. Yeah.
Right. And then there are similar grapes that are grown on every type of soil, and that's where the variation and the taste is, because of whether it's limestone or...
Yeah, part of it. So I think what we were also saying in the book is, like, we are putting the emphasis on the dirt because we are really thinking that has been kind of not enough put under the light. But we are not saying you just test the dirt. Like, you need to... We absolutely understand that the way that a wine taste is linked to the place, linked to the soil, the farming, of course, but then to the vintage, to the grape, to the all the composants that people are calling still terroir, which is still a very meaningful word, with that a single place in the world is very different. So even you can have a Chardonnay growing on limestone, if you're in Champagne, if you're in Chablis, and if you're in the Côte de Beaune, you know you are not necessarily going to get the same first, because the limestone is slightly different, but the climate is different, the microclimate is different. And what we also, you know, talked a lot about the winemakers when we were doing the books. They were saying us, you know, one of the big thing about the soil, it's not necessarily the mineral compound or the soil, is like really the physical capacity of drainage and light and heat retention. And at the end, you know, the great soil are the ones that help to deal with climate and vintage variation. Like the great soil are the ones that are able to absorb over, like, extraordinarily warm or extraordinarily wet, and survive.
And to produce something in most vintages that is beautiful, the one that you have to do the less to correct.
Right.
But, you know, the book acts on so many different levels. On the most simplistic level, I really wanted it to be a way to people to just go, wow, let me just discover all the limestone, you know, like, places in the world in one place. You can go to this book and see that, or granite, or all those things. And I have wanted that in my own wine life so often.
There's a lot of usable information. I mean, at the end of each chapter,
further.
I mean, you do break it down by the three rock types, but then you talk about the specifics, limestone, clay, and all of that. And there's a treasure trove of specifics, you know, of specific winemakers, you know, recommended wine types, regions and all of that. So, I mean, it's the type of book that you could walk away with specific, you know, selections and idea. I mean, it's fair to say that at the end of every chapter.
I think
chapter.
It's fair to say that.
Yeah. Do farmers have to farm differently with the different soils? I mean, there's not... If you're an organic biodynamic, you're farming a certain sustainable style way. But does it vary, or it's really the same thing? You take care of the land takes care of you type.
Well,
thing.
It's not just the subsoil or the rock that you have to take into consideration, but also where you are. So if you're in a wet area or a dry area,
right.
No matter, you may have the same... You know, like bedrock, but you're going to have to deal with the topsoil very differently.
Right.
So it depends.
Right. So it definitely a different approach for every area.
Yeah, but what we kind of realize also is like every winemaker every plot is very different. So we are amazed by how everybody is really working in a different way, just because, as Alice is mentioning, not one plot of vine will be the same. And I think what we can characterize about organic and biodynamic, which is at the end, first, and like I say, it's not using a certain type of chemical product, it is also a sense of observation and a sense of how to understand the plant the best, to have the most biodiversity and strength in the plant itself.
Right.
So that it's different everywhere in the world. So like these farmers we are talking about, are really working on getting the best strength, the more complex strength to the plant, so the plant per se can have a very active root system, can have a very active and healthy photosynthesis, can defend itself again disease, and so on and so on and so on. So it's a more an observation approach than just saying, oh, you know what, they're just organic, because it's a bit too simplistic to think like that.
I want to ask you a couple more things, then I want to talk a little about natural wine. We're talking to Alice Firing and Pascaline LePeltier. Their new book, The Dirty Guide to Wine, is out. Pascaline, I was just curious. You know, you're an MS. You've seen a lot of, you know, SOM tests and all of that. I mean, are there any references or tastings or tests that reference soil or rocks, or it doesn't really get that deep? Just a curiosity.
When we blind taste, we indeed mention minerality.
Okay.
You know?
But nobody likes that term, right?
And nobody likes that term.
Minerality. Really. It's dangerous.
It's a dangerous term, but it's here. It's appearing, you know, in a blind testing. So, as we said, that I tickle that down in the foreword. We're saying, for me, minerality is a false problem. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that doesn't exist. I think today the tools that we have to understand minerality are not adapted to the concepts or the criteria we are trying to use to express minerality or may not be the best and the most accurate to do so. Thus, we go to say, oh, there is no minerality because I can't. Right. Have a direct contact, like there is not a direct link between the classic oyster shell of Chablis and the smell of oyster shell. It's not because we can't conceptualize it, and today we can't scientifically prove it, that it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means that right now we are not intellectually equipped to understand it. We can't, but we, it's funny because in blind testing we are talking about it all the time.
Right.
So is it part of sulfur compound due to certain yeast strength in the fermentation? Is it something way more complex due to the composition of the must that is linked to the way that the grape has been grown, that is linked to the ability of the plant to extract certain nutrients from the ground? You know what? I know there is a lot of work's being done right now in laboratory to think about that and to try to understand this, but we are just at the very, very beginning. And life is extraordinarily complex. As we know, life is the most complex thing. And maybe our scientific brain is not ready yet to put it on a paper and to say this is how it works. Yet, there is something, and we were, Alice and I, you know, after talking about the book and writing that book, we kind of went down to say, you know what, the way we maybe feel it is not going to be in the aromas, but more in a certain structural expression of the wine that is usually expressed through the acidity and the tannic structure. Mm-hmm. And if we may dare to go and say there is some parallel, maybe the way to get into it is to really pay attention to this parameter, which are the acid and the tannic structure.
Right. Alice, let me ask you one last thing about the book. Why did you devote a separate chapter, unlike other regions, to the Alsace?
Alsace.
Yeah.
There's just such a huge variety of...
It needed its own chapter.
Yes, it's really hard to categorize it. There's quite a... Most of the Grand Cru are limestone, and we could have gone there, but that would have been a great disservice, and so it seemed like a wonderful illustration to say... And now you can deconstruct everything you know.
Right. Put it at the end. Here's right. what you know. Now let's apply it right. to this region. I didn't think of it that way, and now it makes total sense.
And in a way, many years ago, and it wasn't many years ago, I think 2011 or 2012, when I was in Alsace, and I was at this restaurant in the northern part of the region that had a wonderful, it was a fabulous restaurant, and it had a wonderful wine list, and it was segregated into rock type. And so you could totally taste Riesling from six
different... Is that the first time you saw that?
That is the first time I saw it.
Acknowledged it and made a mental note.
Totally.
Like, this is, you know,
it really
cool,
drove
interesting
it home.
Way. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it made sense.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
It was great.
It made sense for us too. It's not like it was something that was made up, you know, because after that you saw a couple of wines going out in the U.S. about salt, like kind of salt type, but was more made up. Like you could see there was no...
Right.
But in others... It's true to the place to
is Alsace as good a region to do it that way? I mean, it's just set up better.
They really have it because of the big mountain range that collapsed. What happened to which formed Alsace, and
right.
it's it really just had such a mishmash of so many different soil types. So it was the poster child for that
why.
Kind of thing. And it didn't seem right to ignore it because we're both great fans of the wines from Alsace, which is a region that doesn't get as much love as it should.
No, and I think in time you will see that.
I think that's
going to
change.
Yes, sommeliers will cheerlead for it. They'll carry more of it. Mm. You know, they'll talk about its diversity, food pairing, and all of that. All right, let's talk about natural wine for a minute or two. We spoke earlier, you wrote a book about the industrialization of wine, mm-hmm. organic, certified biodynamic, all that stuff. And natural is a crazy term. Alice, in your mind, what makes a natural wine natural? Is it the certification? I mean, we all agree nothing added, nothing taken away mm-hmm. is a practice in winemaking on the land. But how do you
Well, that's starting with at least organic viticulture, nothing added, nothing taken away, and that is a philosophy more than a dogma. And so for me, this is a wine that I experience it as being alive, that changes with every sip, that is feels
why
good in my body.
Why is it alive versus, a Bordeaux or a Cali Cab? Because
there could be, actually, there are one or two California Cabernets that I could definitely put in that category, and there are more than a few Bordeaux that I can put in that category. So I don't want to really just,
right.
you know, like...
Dish on it.
Totally.
Right.
But... Let's put it to a market-driven wine as opposed to a wine that is really representative place with none of the 72 perfectly legal legal additives that are allowed in wine, not the high level of sulfite added that is allowed from like 160 parts per million and up.
You know, people realize there's sulfites in wine, but there's so much other crap that
right.
can be added and is added.
But just talking about sulfites, if you're talking about 160 or 180, what's the legal? We're at like 160 parts per million.
That's a measurement, parts per million.
As opposed to maybe 30 parts per million, that is a huge difference, and you're going to get a huge difference in the way you're experiencing that wine in your mouth. because that sulfur really, it's it traps the wine. It basically hairsprays it in place.
Right.
And a lot of the additives do that as well. It fixes the color. And somebody in the marketing room is deciding, we need this kind of color, and we need this kind of mouthfeel, and we need this amount of sugar, residual sugar in there. And like, no, I don't want your idea. I never drank soda. It's not my
culture.
There's
been a lot of talk. Eric Asimov approached it. Bianca Bosker made some statement about it, creating wines for the market, you know, for consistent taste. The opposite of what we're talking right. about and what should be done. Is sulfur one of the few things that a practicing natural winemaker will add as little as he can or mm-hmm. none?
Yes.
And nothing else.
And nothing else. And there are plenty of people making beautiful wines who are not adding any sulfite at all. And that's what they do. And they're really successful at it. So it is very possible.
Right.
But I'm not going to. I mean, personally, I drink things between 0 and up to 40.
But you cap it somewhere.
I do, except when I'm dealing with some wonderful traditional wine. And that's what they
right.
do. And it's, you know. So. Like Lopez de Ardea, that's natural enough for me, even
right.
though the sulfite level is higher.
And Pascaline, higher. You drink a lot of, you know, the wines that you love are low sulfite anyway. Do you have a cap like Alice? I will not drink anything above 50.
But I don't think it's that
I'm
made that
I'm
cap.
I'm making fun.
But it's more like you realize, you know what, these are the wines that I like, and I can feel
right.
it more. But let me, I don't want to.
It's, you know, and at least the sulfur question is also it's way more complex, you know. Everything depends also when the sulfur has been added,
yes.
which type of the pH of the wine, which type of sulfur
sulfite
are you adding?
Right.
Yes.
It goes way beyond what we're talking
about. Are you adding
maybe
sulfite
right.
Potassium? Are you doing
volcanic
sulfur?
Yeast is not yeast. It's complex.
Yeah. So
sulfur, I guess, the same.
I think you just develop as you taste. You just hopefully develop a palate that is more and more sensitive to certain things when you can feel a certain level of sulfur. But sulfur bothers me like Alice when it's just stripped out of the wine. You know, when the problem is when you need to aerate your wine so much to get something out of it,
right.
Nose and palate wise, and you think
that's not good.
It's just not. It's not good, but it's just.
It's dead. It feels
it's, right.
It feels
it's not
dead.
Natural. It should come about on its own with all
it
that.
It just come about, or you know, it's also certain wine are made with like the winemaker intentions, really not to release this wine for 20 or 30 years. So it's really want to protect the wine for the long run. If it's for something you want to drink on the younger side, it's definitely. Unfortunately, it takes something away from the wine and
right.
from the work of the winemaker. But it also means for me that the stability of the wine per se is maybe not strong enough that the winemaker felt that he had to really use more to make his
right.
wine more stable,
right.
which means that maybe it was not as stable as it should have been to start.
Right.
So it's a way more complicated subject than that. I think I hate more like everything going from like bad back oak treatment and gum and all like this
yeah.
kind
right.
of sulfur is also like I think it's time I wouldn't say to move on from that subject, but keeping the subject
not,
of natural wine just
well
on
on,
like,
right.
on sulfur, I think you just
you're missing the point
right. of why that became a question. And honestly, I would love to do some tasting with people about sulfur level, and I will be in blind, and I think people will be very surprised to think they know where there is and
yeah,
there isn't. It's really difficult.
I think you know the wines, and if you set it up, I think
it's
the result,
difficult.
You're right about that. Alice, do you still have aspirations of making a natural kosher wine?
I do.
Do you? Is
I
that
do.
Something you'll one day pull the trigger
I
on,
do.
Or you just
Every
think about it?
Every vintage, I'm thinking this one, and I'm trying to find... And you know, it's complicated to find actually the rules of what I need to do, and it pisses me off a great deal that as a yeshiva girl, I cannot handle the wine
so
myself.
So I've been to enough seders
otherwise I'd make it.
And breakfasts and Rosh Hashanah dinners, drank a million kosher wines. None of them are natural?
You know, there may be one out of British Columbia.
But it's so, it's one.
Right.
Okay. So that's...
Oh, actually, there's a guy... Well, it's close. And it's pretty close. Fora Gates in Santa Cruz.
Okay.
I'd pull it as... Binyamin, I'd put him as the closest we have to a natural wine in kosher.
We were up at the Culinary Institute a week ago. A bunch of us from Heritage went up, and I'm driving down back to New York, and I see the Kedem Winery. Yeah. You know, I think it used to be on the Lower East Side. You need to go up there and convince those guys and show them how to do it. You know, I'll buy it. All right, we have to take a quick break. We're talking to Alice Firing and Pascaline LePeltier. We're talking about their new book, The Dirty Guide to Wine. We're going to come back, and we are going to subject Alice and Pascaline to our wine list. We want to get their take on a few things. So you're listening to The Grape Nation, and we'll be right back.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
1-8-6-2-8-2. All right, we're back. We're back with Alice Firing, and we're back with Pascaline LePeltier. And I want to buzz through this pretty quickly because I want to taste a little wine too. And we'll talk a little more about the book. But let's do the wine list first. It's a bunch of questions. Alice, you answer first, then Pascaline. Don't dwell on it. Let's make this a speed round. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? What's interesting you? Is it seasonal? Is there a region you want to taste through? What's on your table now?
Well, sometimes I don't have the luxury of drinking what I want to drink because I've got to taste so much. But a wine that I can't get enough of, I feel so boring. It's Domaine Guillon, a Bourgogne.
Spell Guillon for me.
G-U-I-O-N.
Guillon.
From Bourgogne, not really next door to Chinon in the Loire, and it's ridiculously cheap and ridiculously delicious and completely savory, and I love it to pieces.
Okay.
But if it's summer, I'm drinking Muscadet.
Okay. All right, Pasca?
I'm totally digging Petit Mont 5. Like, I'm in my Petit Mont 5, Grand Mont 5 kind of kick right now.
Petit what?
Petit Mont 5, M-A-N-S-E-N-G.
What is that?
It's an amazing grape from the southwest of France that you find in Jurançon and Irulegui.
Okay.
It's an unsung hero. After Chenin, we'll drink Mont 5 all the time, and I'm like...
Can we find a bottle of Rouge Tamar?
You can find a lot. I think I probably have the biggest Mont 5 list.
All right, that's a good one. All right. Alice, favorite wine and food pairing? I know it's a goofy question, but you've drank so much wine and ate so much food and they've crossed paths.
Okay.
What makes sense?
Last week I had one that I thought was fabulous. It was a Yona Schimmel Cabbage Knish. With
like
Vino di Luce Rosato sparkling wine from Metna, and I thought it was awesome.
Now, I will tell you and guarantee you that of all the shows I've done, nobody's ever gave me that pairing.
I bet.
And I'll put good money down, nobody else does, so we'll leave it at that. Pasca?
It's her job.
It's my job, yeah. Chenin with everything.
Chenin with everything.
That's
it. I'll buy that. Done
it.
Right there. Don't need to waste any more time. Guys, tell me your favorite wine restaurant and or bar. And I ask that not to get you in trouble. You know, you own your partner in a restaurant and all that. But who's doing it right besides you guys? Where the wine service, the selection, the environment, the food. Do you have a...
Well, in the... in New York City, hands down, it has to be Rouge Tomat.
I agree.
Because nobody has, and I was just speaking about this today with somebody else, because no place has the depth and the history
and
on
the
that
thoughtfulness
list.
To what they're
everything.
Doing.
So it's like, you know, that is, I just have to say that. Okay, and if I was forced to choose another place?
Give me one more.
It's hard.
Is it a neighborhood thing? Is it a destination
I
to
really
you?
I really like Four Horsemen. I like going to
okay.
Four Horsemen.
Okay, a good natural bar in Brooklyn. We had Justin on end of last year. Mm-hmm. That's a great choice. Yeah. Interesting place. Pasca, do you... I see you hang out at other places.
When I can, when I'm off.
Yeah.
I really like Four Horsemen too. Hands on to Sauvage mm-hmm. and the guy at Maison Première.
Yeah.
It's a great place, great price, great selection.
Those are great places.
So it's...
All right. Now, do you, Alice, have a favorite all-time wine? Do you have a wine that...
Well...
When asked this question, you
I
have
still,
an answer.
I mean, I guess I still almost tear up and say, well, Cloroche Blanche is no longer in existence. And I haven't since... They sold off their land since Katrine got
when
rid of the land.
When was this?
2014 was their last vintage.
Oh, so it's fairly recent.
And so I haven't had a replacement. And it's because for years I would say, of course, it's Cloroche Blanche. So
that's,
I can't
okay,
do
you're
that.
In trouble.
But if I'm going to do it, then I'll probably say, either Jo Landron or Marc-Olivier Muscadet.
Okay. Yeah. Those are some... good choices. Nothing too fancy, nothing too expensive. What about you, Pasca? Shannon. What else?
That is a tough one. If I have one bottle would be a Chartreuse.
Chartreuse.
Yeah. Old Chartreuse, old Tarragona.
Right.
From like,
I
that
need
is
to come
amazing.
Into Rouge Tomat, and you need to sit with me for a half an hour and give me a quick primer and tasting. We don't have to go through all of it. But I know nothing about Chartreuse.
Oh, my God. Your life is going to get better soon.
I know. All right. So, Alice, you sort of answered this before. I'm not sure it's the appropriate question for you guys, but I think in all your travels and writing, I always ask people the best wine around $15 to $20 are red and white.
I already have.
Yes. You gave me one, and I think Muscadet, too. Pasca, if you
prices
had,
are going up.
My son is in his mid-late 20s. He's going to a dinner party with friends. They're making nice food. He wants to bring 2-3 bottles of wine. Spend $15-$20. What's he bringing, red, white?
Yeah, he's still going to the Loire. Huh? I'm so sorry to
no,
be
the
such
Loire
a...
Loire is it.
The Loire is it. I think the Loire, for white, I would go Loire. Loire Muscadet, Loire... Even Chenin, you have so much choices for the Loire.
Okay.
Touraine. Like,
red too for?
I can also give some love, I think, to the Southwest for red.
Okay. That's a good idea.
Give me something specific.
Something specific for red. Elian Darros, Côte du Marmandais, à Bourioux. Le vin est une fête. So we are downstream from Bordeaux, and Elian works with the same grape variety. Beautiful Merlot based. I like Merlot when Merlot is done like that, and it's absolutely delicious. It costs nothing.
And reasonably priced.
Super reasonably priced. Super complex can
okay.
age. So I will.
That's why I asked you. You gave us the right answer. All right, I'm going to ask you a stupid, silly, nerdy, dumb question. Never asked anybody this before. If you had to pick a favorite. Of the three rock regions, igneous, sedimentary, or metamorphic, and one of those areas characterize wines that you love the most. Can you answer that?
I can.
Okay, what is it?
Granite.
Granite, because it's where?
Well, it's one of those other things that you realize that some of your favorite wines come from.
Okay,
granite.
That's what I was trying
and
to
then
get
I went,
to.
Oh my God, I'm a granite slut.
Okay.
So it's the Northern Rhone.
New title for Alice, Granite Slut.
And she has a t-shirt already, so yes. Yes.
There you go. All right. What about, Pasca, what about you? Same or?
Schist.
Schist?
Mm.
And we find schist where?
In Anjou.
In Anjou?
Chenon Schist, where I'm from.
So does Chenon... grow on other things besides schist or mostly schist?
Chenin grows on all the soil type. The most famous,
okay.
It does.
Okay, because I remember I was at Rouge Tomat and Jim gave me a Chenin. He said, this comes from a very funky soil rock and it'll have a different characteristic.
I probably gave you something from central France, from Aveyron. Which is a bit more granitic.
Yeah, and it definitely was distinct in all of that. All right, those are all great answers. I may have to come back to you guys for some spell checking, but what we do is we post those answers on our website and Facebook page. All right, we have a few minutes left. I want to taste a little wine. Pascaline, you brought in a Muscadet, right?
Yeah, and you brought a Muscadet,
too. Tell me quickly what you brought in.
I brought 2014 Domaine de l'Écu Orthognes, Orthognes in English. I brought that because it's a very emblematic wine for Alice and I because, first, we are a big fan of the previous owner, Guy Bossard, and his last vintage, Fred Nigger van Erck took over the estate, but Guy was one of the pioneer of organic and biodynamic farming in Muscadet, which in an area where you can definitely kill yourself trying to farm organically and biodynamically. And Guy also was one of the first bottling different soil type. So you can find his Muscadet with three
it's
different...
It's L'Écu-L'Apostrophe-E-C-U. Right.
So you can find the Gneiss, the Orthognes, and Granite. And if you test them side by side, they're made the same way. You can't deny there is something
really?
Different. Yeah. So I brought it because it was one of the most emblematic ones. And you brought a Clisson from Pépière, which is
right. So every
awesome.
Week we taste a different wine on air. For our weekly wine sip this week, I brought in a 2014, so we're on the same vintage years, a Domaine de la Pépière Clisson Muscadet. How do you pronounce S-E-V-R-E?
Sèvres-et-Maine.
Sèvres-et-Maine. The wine retails for about $18 to $26, available at better wine shops. The L'Écu, how much is it?
Same price. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So the Clisson, the Pépière, what did we say, rock?
So Clisson is one of what's happening in Muscadet right now. They are subdividing the region, which is a pretty big one, which Muscadet Sèvres-et-Maine in that case, in communal cru or growth based on soil type. So it's amazing that you brought that because it's what's happening there.
Right.
And Clisson should be mostly granite. It's a bit more complex than that, but to make it simple, it's going to be granite.
So I have more acidity on this wine than the L'Écu. Am I right about that? Or not necessarily?
There is slightly more acidity. Granite is also, for me, especially in Muscadet, tends to be a little bit more closed down. So Guy is telling that, Orthognes and Gneiss are kind of more open, given, broader, more fleshy, and granite that you can keep, 1 to 10 years, and granite you can keep it forever. So granite is always, for me, a bit more close in terms of the aromatics when young,
yes.
And just more tense, not as fleshy.
Yes.
You always get a kind of a brininess too in a back palate. Like
there's definitely a salinity.
And it's like
and
a celery salt.
Sea breeze.
Yeah. And a touch
versus
of
the other one.
Vegetal, the touch of vegetal hint at the very, very end, like kind of a sage quality. There is a slightly more varietal thing that is always, for me, young granite tends to be like that in the Muscadet.
The mouthfeel is
fantastic.
Medium to full, right?
Also because they have to be able to put the cru on it, they have to do a longer aging on the lees. So there is definitely a wish, like when you find now Muscadet with a cru designation, you know that the yield are lower, and the aging is a bit given to build wine to age. So anything, it's beautiful wine.
Color-wise, typical color, yellowish?
Yeah, you can see it's a bit more gold, which is
gold.
Also like for Muscadet, which is also linked to the fact that both Pépière and Écu are definitely harvesting riper grapes than most of the Muscadet estates, and they are looking for that to get that maturity to allow them to go through a bit more extensive aging. And there is definitely that color is linked to the aging of the wine for the Clisson.
I think it has a pretty long finish.
Yeah, it's a long finish.
I don't want to use the word minerality, but there's definitely some stone, crushed stone, or is that the granite in there?
It's way more complex than that. But I think what
I
you
knew it, Alice. I knew I was way off.
No, but I always, like when I train my staff about this idea of minerality, I always do a very simple tasting, which is perfectly filtered water and spring water with a high level of mineral content.
Minerals, right.
And when you compare them side by side,
You can really tell.
Right. So, you know, it's not as direct in a wine, but definitely the fact that you are finishing on something very salty with a high citrusy feel in terms of your acidity, you are not finishing on the alcohol. The fruit is discreet and you are more on a sapidity and a savoriness, link you to feel that that finish that is almost a bit tactile, link you to think that there is something more than just glycerol, alcohol,
eloquently
and water.
Eloquently said. Now, the two wines, what's a good food pairing for these wines? Traditionally, is it something, or what would you recommend for a good Muscadet? These are better Muscadets.
These are definitely good Muscadet. I think you can have a blast with, if you just want to get geeky without being too geeky, I would have a blast with a bunch of oyster.
Okay.
And I would do
always
kind of a correlation
with
Eastern and Western Coast, for example. So go with like higher, brinier, more assertive oyster.
Because
you can go
of
with
the salinity, they match well with a brinier oyster.
Yeah, it's a classic pairing, but then just
right.
I have a couple of different oyster with them, like and just try to see when you get more fleshier, sweeter, softer oyster. For example, from the West Coast, I would go more with the Clisson, just because kind of cut through, I will have more brinier, I will go more with the Hertognes. I would have a blast, you know, trying
yes.
different oyster different, with different
right.
Muscadet.
Get a dozen, four different types.
Yeah, but
right.
amazing with like green salad, everything. You have like bitter greens, bitter green, like raw green vegetable with high citrus, lemon-driven vinaigrette. Muscadet is your best friend.
Alice, do we like these wines?
Did I not say that it was Muscadet that's going to be my
yes.
like, yes, oh yes, no.
But
and
these are very good examples. Pepier and Le Coeur.
Marc Olivier is just a Muscadet yeah. master, and it's yep. like he's fabulous. Yes.
yes. And just a side thing, both of these guys practice natural, organic.
Biodynamic certified for Domaine de l'Écu since quite some time, almost
like
20 years.
What about Pepier?
And
he's all organic now.
Organic and certified
okay.
on the yeah. way to certification of yeah. biodynamy.
Okay. All right. So two pretty good wines. Thank you, Pasca, for bringing that in. And we can continue to drink.
At least
we don't have
show.
Time, though.
What did Alice bring in?
Well, actually, we don't have time. It's opened last night.
I'm going to taste it.
It's open
as
last night.
As we're wrapping the
and
show up, we're going to taste it.
I brought
this.
It because it reminded me of Petit Malsang from the Sierra Foothills. And this is from the Dio Madrid.
We're going to drink this while I wrap up.
Okay, so we're drinking four monos, four monkeys from the Dio Madrid, about an hour north of Madrid from Granite.
And it's almost a sherry nose
and,
or something.
And it is actually better today than yesterday. The acidity is totally searing, and it's... Do you see what I mean?
This is an interesting wine.
For the Petit Malsang from La Clarine?
Yeah. If anybody's ever had the Petit Malsang from La Clarine Farm, it's like really similar.
Is
yeah.
it?
A little bit less acidity
yeah.
than Malsang, because Malsang
yeah.
is albio, right, for this
yeah,
one?
Yeah, albio.
All right, so Alice, give me the name of this wine again. Go Slow.
Four monos.
Four monos, M-O-N-O-S?
M-O-N-O-S, four
okay.
monkeys.
Four monkeys. That's monos is monkey in Spanish.
Yes.
See, I'm like a translator. And it's made by?
It's made by a collective of four people. I can't remember all their names now. And they work with with reclaimed vineyards of very old, gnarled vineyards.
And Vinate, no.
No, but it's very similar.
Similar setup.
It's a very similar
okay.
setup and with very similar philosophy.
Okay. I'll get more info after. All right. We're going to wrap up the show. If you have a question, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. We'll post Pascaline and Alice's wine list. And one way or another, I'll figure out all the wines we drank and list them. Because they're goodies and they're interesting, especially Alice's last wine. You can follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and Twitter at BenRuby. And check out our new website, thegrapenation.com. You'll see very flattering pictures of Alice and Pascaline. Mm-hmm. We'll list the wine list answers and, again, the wines we drank. So let's talk about the book. Alice, the book is pretty much available everywhere, Amazon, better booksellers?
Yes, and a lot of wine shops.
Wine shops, too.
Yeah,
good.
A lot of wine shops,
I'm
but
glad.
Certainly Amazon. Barnes
okay.
and Nobles, blah, blah, blah.
All right. So if you're anxious and you want to get it and you're a prime customer, you can go on tonight and probably have it by Friday. It's good weekend reading.
I read it. I recommend it. And then Alice publishes a newsletter.
A newsletter.
Called The Firing Line, F-E-I-R-I-N-G. And it is probably the foremost premier natural, organic, biodynamic wine newsletter as far as information, opinion, news, mm-hmm. all of that stuff. And Alice, how do we get that?
Go on to that, Alice, FEIRING.com/newsletter.
Okay.
And sign up. It's $68 and in a few
weeks. $68 a year.
A year and
it's
a few.
It's nothing, Alice.
I know.
Right.
And a few weeks is going to go into a full-fledged website, so you get access to all the four-year of database.
So the people that are subscribers will morph into the website?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And new people will see kind mm-hmm. of a new presentation. Mm-hmm. I am going to sign up this Great. Week. And Pascaline, Alice, on social media, do we want people to follow you anywhere?
Of course. Follow me everywhere.
Where?
So Alice Firing on Twitter.
Okay.
Alice.Firing on Instagram.
Okay.
And then it's, you know, the regular Facebook
right.
thing.
And Pascaline is a partner and heads up the liquid program at Rouge Tomat in Chelsea. Stop by there anytime for amazing food, an amazing wine list, amazing service. It's a very well thought out place. It's probably one of the healthiest places you'll get drunk at. You know? So, Pascaline, where can we follow you? We could follow at Rouge Tomat, New York City, right? Is that the...
You can follow me at Pascaline Le Pelletier on Instagram.
L-E-P-E-L-T-I-E-R.
Yeah.
Le Pelletier.
And P. Le Pelletier on Twitter.
P. Le Pelletier on Twitter. And Rouge Tomat. All right. So go out and buy the book. Go out and sign up for Alice's newsletter. Go out and eat and meet Pascaline at Rouge Tomat. All right. All right. I want to thank our guests, Pascaline Le Pelletier and Alice Firing, authors of the new book, The Dirty Guide to Wine. I want to thank our engineer, Vitor, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. But before I go away, and I just have a couple more things to say, and Alice, you need to dilute this down to a paragraph or less. The takeaway that you want the people to take away from the book, The Dirty Guide to Wine, is what?
The most important thing is that place matters, and just try to stop thinking about the grape and just go back to the source, because it is where the most exciting stuff is happening.
And there's a lot of places and sources that people should open their eyes to,
yes,
right?
Indeed.
Okay. Don't forget, we are in the midst of our summer fundraising drive, so go to theheritageradionetwork.org/donate to donate. Maybe buy a cheaper bottle of wine this month and use the rest of the money to donate to Heritage. Come on, all right? I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.